WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. The previous program was the Gary Noel Show, heard Monday through Friday at noon. It is now almost 1 p.m. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind coming up.
Everybody, Ben Starr and Kevin O'Donohue here with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Hope everyone's doing well out there on a rainy day here in the New York area. Today we have a guest for you, and a guest that you know if you're a longtime listener of The Positive Mind. Dr. Kent Robertshaw returns to the studio to join us for a discussion on a topic that I think so many of us can relate to. Kent, thanks for being back with us.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Hey, Kent. Welcome back. Yes, Ben, I think it is a topic that most people, if not all people, over 30, maybe over 25, but definitely over 50 or 45, can relate to. And we're talking about some kind of crisis in your life. You know, they call it the midlife crisis, MLC. But, you know, what's midlife these days? You know, they're saying now that baby boomers, over a million baby boomers will live to be over 100.
It's astonishing.
I don't know if you plan on it. I plan on being there.
All right.
I'm a boomer, and a boomer is a 1946 to 1964. 1946 to 1964, and there are 75 million of us. So at least a million of us.
I think it's the largest demographic.
Not anymore.
No?
You were right up until a year ago.
Really?
Guess what's taken over?
I guess the millennials.
The millennials have taken over. And, of course, you know, as the years go on, there's going to be less and less baby boomers. So eventually by, I think, 2049, there's going to be less than 15 million baby boomers. But not me, because I'm still going to be here.
You'll still be here.
I'm still going to be here in spite of the crisis. Because I've had the crisis, if you want to call it that, but I've had the change. I'm going to call it the assessment. I've had the assessment, and we are going to be asking for people to call us during the show if you've had the assessment. And the assessment is that you get an experience that I've got to change my life.
Something foundational makes you rethink everything.
Something happens. Foundational for sure. The foundation under you disappears. And you can't hide from it. You can't deny it. You can pretend, but it's going to keep coming back. It's going to remind you, I am here, sitting here waiting. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing to have it. So we have a great show ahead. We have a great show and an expert on all of this, Dr. Kent Robertshaw. Kent, you don't like the phrase midlife crisis.
Yeah, I think crisis implies that there's conflict or that there's, it's troubled. And for a large amount of people, the reassessment goes fairly smooth in 35, 40 years old, so that it's not necessarily filled with what I would think adolescence is filled with, which is a identity crisis. I think everyone should go through an identity crisis at that time of who they are, what their beliefs are, and challenge it, and not wait until they're middle age to have a crisis of identity. But I think midlife then becomes a time where everybody pauses about all their belief systems, right? And they step back from trying to please others and trying to be powerful and successful as the way they thought they were going to be happy, and reevaluate, well, what is their purpose in life? Who do they trust? What do they believe in? And you should come out of that feeling a sense of self-awareness and goal-driven to what's going to be your life, what is going to be the purpose of your life, what matters.
I think a lot of it has to do with not being afraid of it. You know, I mean, the way you're describing is it can be a very graceful period of life. that, yes, you're making this transition, making this change, and all these good changes, and it can be a graceful experience. But the hard part is when people fight it. So in your identity crisis, everybody has an identity crisis, right? I mean, isn't
that? Absolutely. Right, because you're separating, again, at adolescence, right? Everybody needs to go through a period where they're thinking to themselves, who's Kevin? Who's Ben? Who's Ken? Who are you? Who's Donald Trump? Who's my priest? Who's my rabbi? Who's my parents? Who's my teacher? Mm. What is all this gobbledygook psychoanalysis for? That's healthy. Otherwise, you're like, I'm just following orders, right? Like Nazi Germany. You're just like drinking the Kool-Aid of the society and mom and dad and the priest and rabbi, and you're just becoming a mini-me, right? You're becoming a little clone, particularly of mom and dad. And we could talk about why some people have a very hard time with that period of their life. But otherwise, you're not becoming yourself. You're not leaving the family of origin. You're just becoming a clone of your parents, of their belief system and their wants and needs. And you're not becoming your own person.
So, Kent, are you saying that the earlier the identity crisis happens, the better? That is to say that people who experience that sort of rebellious separation in their teens are better off for the long run because they won't have to have that reckoning later in life?
Word. Absolutely.
All right.
I'm trying to be hip.
That's a millennial
response. And pretend I'm not middle age.
And almost it should be encouraged. Like if you see your kid having an identity crisis, I mean, let them have it. Let them stay with it. I think, you know, a few years is a good amount of time. To have an identity crisis, because what happens in middle age, I mean, we're all going to have this experience in middle age. I'm going to die. I am. I see my life. I see where I've been, and I see what's ahead. And so here's a little bit of a crisis, and we're all going to have to deal with that. But for an adolescent to, you know, if you don't go through that in adolescence, it's going to really, really be difficult when you get to 45, 50, 55 to handle the awareness that, oh, I have been following a script. I didn't really ask who I was when I was young. I didn't have a chance. I mean, there's the biggest problem. Because we're saying two things. One is to encourage an identity crisis in your child if they're having one. And two, for those of you who didn't have one, why didn't you have one? And what is, well, you know, well, can again, you talk a little bit about why people might not have an identity crisis, how they might pass by it?
Yeah, because I think, you know, starting at 2 years old in the quote-unquote terrible twos as opposed to the delicious two, your two-year-old is saying no, right? And saying, you don't control me, you don't own me. I'm my own little person at 2 years old, right? So when my children want to go outside in the 20-degree weather without gloves, I embrace that of like, good, you have a little bit of a backbone. And certainly adolescents, when they're going to leave the nest and maybe go to the University of Tokyo, right, go the other side of the world, they have to leave us. They shouldn't need mommy and daddy anymore. They should become their own person and be independent and get grounded in some sense of identity of who they are. And that can have a healthy mixture of, you know, dad, Kent Roberts, likes jazz. I hate jazz, right? You know, and it kind of pisses him off that I don't like jazz, but that's okay. I like hip hop, right? And whatever. His taste, he wants me to be a doctor. I don't want to be a doctor or whatever. So everything you grind through about the belief systems of one's parents, and certainly some parents, and I'm sure some callers can identify with this, they don't like that. It feels like insubordination.
Feels like a slap in the face.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and it could be, again, it's like honor thy parents. You know, one of the Ten Commandments could be taken to some family belief system. Honor thy parents means if I want you to dress this way and act this way and all the above, then you're going to do it. And everything else is breaking the Ten Commandments in terms of being disrespectful to me, your parents. So I think those households, you get people who are just not even aware of what they want and what they need to be happy. They just know what to do to make mommy and daddy happy.
Yeah, so a lot of parents are conspiring to keep their kids from going through an identity crisis even. They're not giving them the room to grow away from us.
Right.
They don't have the ego strength themselves to say, okay, my child is exhibiting really healthy differentiation behaviors, and I'll let them fly. No, right. They're like, oh, don't leave me. I don't want you to leave me and my spouse, because then I have to deal with a whole bunch of stuff.
It's a good point, but I'm not sure that there's malice there.
No,
I think,
it's not.
You know, parents and, like, Kent's talking about this whole framework of elders and societal structures that are trying to guide younger people in a certain direction. I don't think there's necessarily a malice. I think the parents are saying, hey, don't make the same mistakes that I made. Also saying, I don't want to make the same parenting mistakes my parents made, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers and, you know, the religious leaders, it's all coming from a place of good intentions. But I agree with Kent that it is healthy for there to be a pushback on the part of younger people. And that when there's not a pushback, it can probably lead to, you know, reckoning later down the line.
Right. I think that there are some people that go to the grave. We have listeners in their 60s and 70s who just are, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid of their parents and the religion, and they're okay, I guess. You know, they've...
They're not okay. I mean, you're being kind.
Yeah. I think they're, you know, they're living their lives and don't have what we're talking about today. To my mind, midlife crisis is when people, for the first time, 40, 45 years old, come to the realization, particularly like men who are told to be powerful and successful, and Donald Trump being the role model of male, you know, like if you're powerful and you're successful, you're going to be happy, right? And so Kevin and I see...
Boy, did he drink the Kool-Aid. I mean, he was his father's son.
He's still drinking the Kool-Aid.
But anyway, we won't go there.
So we, you know, being in Manhattan, we deal with people who walk in our office who are, you know, so by any standard on this planet Earth, so successful, quote unquote, as it relates to being industrious, doing well in work, making moolah, you know, making that green pieces of paper. And they come into our office thinking that, yes, this will make me happy if I'm successful and I work hard. And they come in and they're very unhappy. We get those group of people. And then we have other people who, again, similarly are unhappy because they didn't become as successful as they want. Mm. So lots of males are coming into our offices saying, I'm unhappy and I need to rethink the belief system that I had, which was, if I'm successful, I'm going to be happy. I'm going to get my house. I'm going to get a second house. I'll pick it at whatever. And then I will be happy. And they find that they're not happy. So then they're really rethinking, what do they want to do? And then you can have your second childhood, right? Then to my mind, a midlife
or your first adulthood.
Yeah,
you know,
because,
you know, the typical guy who does not experience the midlife crisis, the one who, you know, is the guy who goes out, you know, I've been conventional all my life and, you know, I deserve now to, you know, travel the world, buy a Ferrari and get some young women.
Right.
I mean, that's a guy who's just not processing the midlife crisis. They're not really allowing themselves to feel their disappointment and frustrations about the path they've chosen.
Right.
So when you say first, you know, second childhood, I would say first adulthood, those guys, those people, even women, we should talk about how this shows up with women and what the biological or hormonal factors are.
Yeah.
But I think it's really your first chance at being your own man, being your own woman, being your own person, right? Being an adult for the first time. So, you know, we're going to talk more about the positives of this sort of crisis situation, but we're going to want your calls. We'd love people who know what we're talking about to give us a call. Of course, anybody could call who have gone through a change of life moment or a week or a month or experience where they got a flash of something and says, I have to change my life. With the midlife crisis, there's no doubt you can't run from this, that you have to own your life. Take your life in your hand. It's a good thing. And so if people have done that who are listening, give us a call, 212-757-5555.
And the triggers can be so varied, right? I mean, we've discussed this. The triggers can be a difficult event, right? A loss in the family, a loss of a loved one, a personal challenge. Or they can be a positive thing, I guess objectively positive.
Well, your kid graduates from college.
Right. And that's... you know, that's like that creates a real reckoning. Or like Kent mentioned, you finally achieve the level of success that you always dreamed of, and you get there and you're not happy. Like you mentioned, so many of your clients that are, you know, these powerful, successful people, but that are just not fulfilled inside. And I think that's pretty interesting when you consider the range of factors that can lead people here.
Right. And I think, you know, it would be dishonest to say to have a show on the good news about being middle-aged is we're fighting against a culture where Taylor Swift is, you know, a demigod and beauty and
sports
power.
Athletes.
You know. Well, God bless, you know, Tom Brady, though I'm an Eagles fan, thank you very much. But Tom Brady's 40 years old, so he's, you know, he's a role model for a lot of us. But again, he's, you know, considered older, you know, past his prime. You know, what does that mean? Again, I think a lot of people, if they put a lot of stock of their self-esteem based on being strong and powerful and beautiful and youthful appearance and all that, then middle age can be a very hard place of feeling like your status is going down because you've bought into that younger is better.
If you're just joining us, you're tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue. Our guest today, Dr. Kent Robertshaw. We welcome him back into the studio. Kent, you are a clinical psychiatrist here in New York City, and because of that, you are often able to really give us, shed some light on the scientific backgrounds of topics we talk about. And Kevin alluded to it just earlier, but I'm wondering if you could expand on the sort of hormonal differences that are activated between men and women who are going through these sorts of situations.
Yeah, let's talk about men and women and the hormones that are different in men and women, and the idea that in 2018, of course, there's a lot of cultural and societal ways that men and women are different, but there seems to be a lot of evidence that there's some biological difference, that, again, testosterone for men starting in adolescence fuels a tremendous amount of aggressiveness, competitiveness, and ambition and wish for power, and overwhelming sexual urges. So testosterone from adolescent on tends to be a very powerful sort of hormone that men have that leads to, again, competitiveness, aggression, and sexuality.
Even in boys, right? I mean, yeah, let's say you're a five-year-old boy, you know, who likes to play with trucks and build forts and castles and have, you know, whereas the girls are playing with dolls and fantasizing about being home, you know, homemakers and creating a nice home.
And again, some would say, well, that's before adolescence. But in fact, the testicles of a four-year-old and five-year-old is producing a lot of testosterone. So even at that age, there's a marked difference. So that boys not only have statistically at 5 or 6 years old more rough play and aggressive behavior, they want to be first, right? They want to be first in line. Whereas now let's talk about the beautiful women, you know, that make our world so wonderful. They are more motivated at 5 years old, and then it gets really true in their adolescence in terms of caretaking and nurturing. And that becomes very importantly driven by estrogen. Estrogen becomes a very important part where, again, a five-year-old is pushing in front of a line. The girls are the one that's saying, no, it's not fair. Take a turn because I want to fit in. I want to be well-liked.
So here's the question. I mean, can I at midlife, if I'm a man going through midlife malaise or reassessment, I think it's great. I think it's very, very important to go through it. I think it's very important to, as we say, face the abyss and face your death. But you don't have to. I mean, are you saying if I took testosterone injections through my 50s and 60s that I could possibly avoid this reassessment?
Absolutely. You'd be look like Donald Trump. I mean, I hate to bring him up, but he, to my mind, he's an archetypical sort of, you know, very aggressive, competitive, combative, sexually charged person that hasn't gotten to the point of middle age where people are kind of more caring and more nurturing, that many men in their 40s or 50s really decide what is powerful is to be caring.
Let's take a quick call. We have Mark on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Marka.
Hello. Did we lose her?
I think we may have.
Hello. So, hello.
Oh, yes. Hi, Marka.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Help us out here. Give us a women's perspective. Go ahead.
I went through my crisis, or not even crisis. I went through something in my 20s where I decided that I didn't want to go a normal route, which would be trying to get a lot of money, have the house and the children and the husband and all that stuff. I think I discovered Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, and I'm dating myself now, and Krishnamurti. I was on that route. It was the 80s, and my brothers had already done and were already well on their way to making a lot of money, and they do now. And I just didn't do that. And so I'm a creative person, mm-hmm. just as everyone is, and I make money being creative. And
to ask you, the period of the crisis itself, you said it happened in your 20s. Was it a period of anxiety for you, of fear, rebellion, strength? I mean, what were you feeling at the time? Insecurity? I mean, because we're talking about this crisis as a kind of readjustment to life. It's not necessarily pleasurable. I mean, how was it?
No.
How was it for you?
It was a world ahead of me that looked horrible and miserable, and I couldn't go that route. I saw what it did to so many people and friends and family, and that's how they live, and it just didn't look fun, and I went through a lot of sadness and just trying to figure it out. And when I just told everyone, okay, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm quitting that job. I'm not going to work with my brother, who is, by the way, a multimillionaire now. Mm. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go that route. Everyone, they couldn't believe it, and they still can't believe it. Oh, wow, okay, what are you doing today? Well, today I'm collecting leaves or whatever. It's like they just can't grasp it, but it's how I choose to live my life, and I feel really good about that. Many years later,
you sound like you're going to be one of the boomers that lives to 100. You have a great spirit, Marka.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your story.
Yes, thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Be well.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Yes, I'm sorry, 212-757-5555, 212-757-5555. Yes, it can happen in your 20s. It almost sounded like an identity crisis for her, the way, you know, you describe wrestling with concepts of myself. Who am I?
Yeah, like certain values that it sounds like in her family that were important about making money. She, you know, before her midlife was, wrestling with, that's maybe not where my happiness lies, right? I'm not going to be happy just trying to make money and get the house and get objects and, you know, all the materialism, you know, isn't where her happiness lies. Maybe more, you know, a creative sort of spark that she needs to be creative or be in the arts. And obviously we treat people in the arts that seem to be in their teens and 20s. They sort of know that's what they want to do. And it's a very hard life for New Yorkers sometimes to be actors and artists and poets and writers, because it's very, very competitive. I just don't want people to drink the Kool-Aid like every 21-year-old. Yeah. You don't want to be a doctor or lawyer, become an actor or a soccer player or a painter and life will be good, you know, like kind of like The Secret or something, Oprah Winfrey. Mm. There's some practical realities about life in 2018. But it's good that people, you know, have that drive, you know, all the artistic people in our society, they're sort of going against the societal views of what will make them happy, and we value their artistic contributions. And then obviously people on the other side who shut off their artistic creative side, they're the ones that we often see, you know, in their 40s and 50s, bored. I mean, a very underappreciated emotion that people have. Again, not the more sexy ones of anger and anxiety or depression, which fill our couches, you know, a lot as therapists, but boredom, too much time on their hand, and they don't know what they want to do. They know what they need to do to be successful, and I know what I need to do for people to like me. What do I want to do for fun? Where do I get joy other than addictions and things like that? Mm. And that's where some people in their 40s and beyond can really make some creative choices about how to make their life interesting, how to be creative with their life. And often it's a time when people, again, pick up new hobbies and new interests as a way to mix it up a little bit, to challenge themselves, to make life interesting.
That could be like a first question to ask a client that comes who's in their 30s and 40s and 50s. How bored are you on a scale of 1 to 10? Because a lot of what they're dealing with is, okay, I'm in a safe career. I'm making good money. I've got that checked off. I'm doing that. But I've lost contact with my feelings. I've lost contact with a sense of play, a sense of fun, a sense of spontaneity. I don't know how to get to that. And I think it's a product of boredom. But I think also the treatment has to be that you have to hang out in boredom. You have to hang out in the abyss. You have to hang out in the discomfort for a while in order to reimagine or to envision how, you know, in what areas can I be creative? We don't want to just say to people, oh, go take a dance class or go start painting, you know, or start taking up the piano. I mean, at least I don't. I want them to feel what they're missing, to feel their boredom, and to come up with their own vision of what it is that, you know, they could do to spice up their life, to start a new life.
Let's take another quick call. We have 3 minutes before the break. We have Janine on the line. Hi, Janine.
There she is. Hi, Janine. We have 3 minutes. How are you?
Sure. Hi, Kevin. Okay, real quick. Well, you kind of hitting a lot of things that I'm going through, but more is my husband, because I'm living in his brownstone that he inherited. You know that whole story.
Yes, sure, sure, sure.
He lived with his mom for 55 years of his life. Huh? And then as soon as she passed, and I unfortunately moved into the home to raise my kids, but let that go.
Yeah.
And as soon as she passed, her son, who was the one who left the place, he and my husband got this, you know, this money. Oh, crazy for money. Oh, and I was being told by his brother and wife that this is not my neighborhood no more. Not my neighborhood. Yes, in order to sell and leave. You see what I'm saying?
So what, they want to sell the asset and up?
But what I'm trying to say is it was okay for me to raise my kids, and if Mama lived to 150, I wish she did, no one was going nowhere.
Oh,
except that 11-year-younger son who flew the coop when he was 18.
Hmm. So is this throwing you? Yeah. Is this making you angry?
Oh, listen, I'm at the point where we sleep separate. You know that. We spoke about that. I saw Dr. Robershore. Okay. Anyway.
You know,
your family comes first. Your wife and daughters, and 8 years ago, you should have bought your brother out when your mama died, because this is my neighborhood.
See, but now, you know, Janine, it doesn't sound like he's going through a crisis. It sounds like you're going through, or you've gone through it.
Okay, I've gone through it, but what I'm trying to say is 8 years ago, you wanted to uproot your daughters and myself to just go anywhere but here, because you wanted money.
Yeah.
That is not what you do. Now, I don't care where I'm going. Let them do what they have to do.
So you've gone through it. Tell us about...
Tell us
about the pluses of getting on the other side. You have about 30 seconds. What are the pluses? Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, to get on the other side, my husband and I are now not together.
Okay.
That's not a plus. But I want to remain friends. My daughters are now 30 and 26. My 26-year-old moved out, which is wonderful. Mm. My 30-year-old's going to move down, whatever. But
So you have a bright future ahead of you.
I do, and I am a singer and dancer, you know, and I'm hearing half of your story because you said to lower the rate, but, like, I started taking singing lessons only because it's something I've been wanting to do since I'm a kid.
There it is.
You know, but that's not going to make anything. It's just
You watch. You watch, Janine. You do two or three of those things, and you'll see your life will be.
Oh, I've been doing.
Well, you get back to me and send me a CD of you on
Oh, that's not going to happen, Kevin.
I'm throwing out the challenge. Janine, we're going to take our break. Thanks for calling. Always nice to hear from you.
I put in an application to walk dogs.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that's number two. Okay, be well.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Janine.
Bye.
212-757-5555 is the number to call. We are talking with Dr. Kent Robertshaw on the challenges of midlife and identity crises. We're going to take a short musical break, and we'll be right back.
And you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself,
Talking Heads here on WBAI. You're listening to The Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue and our guest, Dr. Kent Robertshaw. He's a clinical psychiatrist here in New York City.
Great choice, Ben. Great choice of music. Got to give you credit on that one. How did I get here?
It's a good question.
How did we get
many
here?
Many of us are asking ourselves that regularly.
Yeah, you know, and as you get older, you ask it more and more, and it's a good thing. How did I get here? Where do I want to go? Because you can't answer the second question until you've asked the first. Ken, talk about sexuality. I mean, as you know, I mean, obviously when your testosterone lowers in your 30s and 40s, and actually in your 40s and 50s, you feel, yes, that the waning desire for sex is very real.
Yeah, I think there's the good news about male and female menopause, the good news, right? And so that men with the decreased testosterone, you're less competitive and are able to connect more in terms of socially friendships. But even the sexual part of it, I think for a lot of men, it could be that much of their 20s and 30s with the powerful surge of testosterone, they find themselves distracted or they find themselves getting into trouble, you know, like lots of people, you know, having affairs and cheating and flirting rather than the maintaining of a relationship, an interpersonal relationship, where they're no longer in love, you know, which is, again, nature's, you know, sort of magical thing. They're in a loving relationship, which feels to me, being in a marriage, is like climbing Mount Everest, right? It's not in love, you know, mind-bendingly sex, white hot, whatever. It's now, you know, I want to have hamburgers, and you say again, you know, it's now negotiating the differences and who's in charge and everything like that. So decreased sexual drive can be a good thing because your life, your expectation is to be a father, to be a mensch, to be caring, to be giving to society, to Boy Scouts, to be volunteering, to be caretaking one's parents.
You know, they say something like midlife is a chance to say, I care about the world. Now I care about the world. I care about my values. What are my values? I went on values that were borrowed from somebody in the past. Now I pick my own values, and they're not going to change because of my sex drive.
Right.
You know,
Erik Erikson, again, sees middle age exactly that, which is, again, a shift away from really self-motive, my self-beauty, my self-power, to one of generativity, which is one that I'm settled, and now I want to give. I want to give to others. I want to give to my children. I want to give to society. I want to mentor people at work. I want to, again, a 20-some-year-old will come on this radio show and be like, oh, I want to get my own TV show. I hope everyone's listening and thinks I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread. Mm. Whereas we're hoping we're at a point where we want to educate people in middle age. We want to give. It's not about me and my ego. It's about wanting to give psychological information to people sort of altruistically, you know.
And which is why middle-aged men are here at the Positive Mind Center and my Positive Mind Show talking about psychology and midlife crisis and giving to the world. We do have a caller, Ken. I don't want to interrupt you, but we have a caller, John, on the phone. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Well, you know what your guest just said is really the gospel. According to your guest, it is the gospel.
No, go ahead.
I am a pre boomer. I'll be 77 this year.
Yes, sir.
And I didn't know that there was others out there who actually felt and was doing exactly what he just said. I made my money. I grew up in a small town in South Carolina, African American, on my own since I was 14. Came north after I graduated high school. Made a few dollars.
Did you have a sense of who you were at a young age? John, did you have a sense of who you were at a young age?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Okay. My father, where I grew up, you always had that role model. Whether it was your father, your uncle, your older brother, or the guy next door, you saw what they did, and it's not so much that you followed in their footsteps, but they gave you that foundation of that moral righteousness that you had to respect others. In other words, you had to do unto others as they did unto you.
Yeah.
You whatever you was blessed with was not just for your blessing.
Mm.
The way we survived in the South back then was we shared.
No.
You shared with your neighbors, your friends, your family, whoever.
Mm.
And so that thing was in me. And my family relocated to Florida, and I was on my own at 14 years of age, because I hated Florida.
Mm.
I love it now. I go there now once a year. But I hated Florida when I was 14.
Yeah.
And so I was on my own at 14. I was in South Carolina on my own. And I stayed there, got out of high school, graduated high school, came to New York, worked three jobs at one point. Now I'm comfortable.
Right.
And the problem with successful people, I think their priority is on things, not people.
Yeah.
You see, when your priority start being on things and not other people, you got a problem. And that's why you see all this rant and raving from 45.
Yeah, so John, it sounds like you found yourself a new family in life. I mean, so at 14, you lost your family. Then you graduated high school and then ended up coming to New York.
I didn't lose them.
Go ahead.
I visited them every summer. Every summer I went to Florida.
Uh-huh.
Every summer I went to Florida.
Okay.
But when I graduated, I came north.
Yeah.
And when I got north, I married my high school sweetheart at a young age. That was common back then.
Mm.
And I married my high school sweetheart. We came north together. And we started working. My dreams was to make sure that my offspring didn't have to go through what I went through.
Mm.
You see? And so I made sure that they had all the necessity. Not the luxury, but the necessity. And so though we were able to give them some of the necessities, we didn't give them to them because we wanted them to be grounded.
Yeah. Did they learn how to share?
Oh, yeah. They share right now. I mean, anybody who doesn't have a family, anybody who reaches out for a father figure or family figure, we're there.
Mm.
I taught them that, and that's how they are. And I raised four kids, four offspring here in New York, and I adopted. Not legally, but I adopted three other girls.
John.
Who didn't have a father figure in their life.
Kent, do you have a question? John, we're going to interrupt you because you have a beautiful, beautiful story, and I thank you for giving us a call. It sounds like, you know, you found a way to be in the world, that you found sharing and being connected to people. Some kind of values have gotten you through life.
Well, that's what it's all about, really, about others. I mean, that's why we're all here, to make this world a better place. We're not here
there you
to
go.
Be greedy.
So I'm going to throw out this word that Kent mentioned, generativity. It's, you know, generativity. It sounds like you've been in touch with that for a very, very long time. Kent?
Yeah, again, it sounds like, John, your capacity to take on more than four children, which, again, is a lot of giving, a lot of generosity, a lot of caring for others. And, again, you also said you were successful to some degree. So it's really a balancing act that you did very well that lots of men can't do, which is, you know, working hard, being industrious, but not working to the point that that defines my identity and I want things and material things will make me happy, a certain amount of success financially to then be able to give to myself and, you know, treat myself well and to give and connect to others, friends, church, children, all the above, as connecting. Again, connecting, not competition. Lots of men are deeply stuck in competing with other people, not about connecting. It sounds like you have that, John. You have a good balance.
I like to believe I do. Yes, I like to believe I do have that balance.
John, keep calling us. Keep calling us here at The Positive Mind.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 212-757-5555. Beautiful man. Beautiful man. Generativity. What happens if you're not generative, Kent? I mean, there is a danger when you go through this adjustment, midlife crisis we call it, but it's really an adjustment and an assessment. I think it's an opportunity for assessment that, okay, it can be dark. it's like I have to manage all these new feelings and new thoughts, and they're not always, you know, full of energy for me.
Well, Erickson said the risk of this stage is stagnation, is to sort of get stuck.
Okay.
And to not evolve, to be stuck in an idea that many of my patients have, which is they need a second home or a third home to be more powerful. They need bigger antlers, you know, as it were, you know, that somehow, again, that power and self-esteem is still tied up in their 40s and 50s, and that they just need to work harder and make more money and move up the hierarchy in their business or something, and then they'll be happy. So that can go on. Also, people get, you know, they get very immune to sort of new ideas or new ways of thinking. And then often people can just have this kind of bitter cynicism that they project their own disappointment in themselves on the world. These are the people, the curmudgeons, and you know who they are in their 40s and 50s, where they're just bad-mouthing everything all the time. Police, WBAI, Dr. Robert Chow, you know, every institution stinks, and it used to be better once upon a time, the good old days. People like that, I think, are constantly filled with a sense of failure and not feeling happy, and they're just projecting, as it were, all their disappointment really with the person in the mirror to all these institutions, and with some idea that I was happier once upon a time.
It's a good time to assess your unconscious. I mean, because a lot of people who are making these comments and the cynicism's unconscious, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think the people that are locked into this rigidity are aware of it. And so it's an act of love to really point it out to people that, you know, you're in a down mood. You know, are you going through something? What are you avoiding? I think that's a great question to get at the unconscious. What do you think you're avoiding? What is it you don't want to look at? So when people are, like you say, set in their ways, even at age 40, now I'm reminding people that that baby boomers can live to be 100. To be locked into this in your mid-40s is a bad thing. Is a chance to really get to the other side. We have Alan on the phone. Alan?
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right, Kevin. First of all, let me talk to the doctor. Doctor, how are you doing today?
Very good, Alan. How are you doing, sir?
All right, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Roosevelt Hospital. You're admitted to site. You go in there because you are down. All right, let's say that there's too much oxygen. You're given too much oxygen in the incubator. So they say there's brain damage. You go in there, and Dr. Nicky, I quote doctors' names. He says, okay, Alan, you feel good. Don't take your medicine. You can refuse it. Then they take you to court. You go before a judge, and Dr. Nicky says, he tells the truth, he doesn't lie, because he can't lie in front of a state judge. Now, my question is, why is it that doctors in New York and all over bring restraining orders against people who don't want to take medication? And
Alan, I'm going to interrupt you, because that's a good question for a psychiatrist, but we're here talking about some kind of change in life, a kind of crisis. Have you any experience with that?
Yeah, I have had crises.
Go ahead, tell me about it.
Well, I was depressed because I couldn't get a job, and my best friend, back in 1968, killed himself. Yeah. He was depressed. He couldn't get a job. He had a master's degree in music. He took an overdose of pills. He was doing street drugs. Okay, but
so how old were you in 1968?
I was born in 1946. Okay.
Wow. So there it is. You know, there you experienced.
So what happened was, in my family, two of my cousins, Sheldon Roenick and Sheldon Bloom, they had psych problems. I have one. I'm manic depressive, okay?
Yeah.
I have to admit that. Now, I will say this to you.
Do you miss your friend? What was your friend's name?
Dave Bishop.
Do you miss him?
I do miss him, yes. I also miss Dr. Joseph Altieri. He killed himself. He was a psychiatrist.
Yeah, Alan, you have a lot for us to handle here. It sounds to me, you know, you've met these crises in your life.
Yeah.
But it sounds to me like you need a really good cry.
No, I already had that.
Yeah. When was the last time you cried?
Yesterday. But
yesterday.
I feel great. Yeah.
What brought on the tears yesterday?
So, doctor, let me ask you a question. How many people do you have? What hospital do you deal? What hospital do you work at?
I'm in private practice, and I have to tell you, Alan, that one of the things I think you're talking about is that we live in a culture where you don't want to look inside and question your values and take risk and start new hobbies and interests at middle age, because it's very hard to do, because you could fail miserably, just like when you're 5 years old. This is hard stuff, to reevaluate your values, wonder what my life is about, and also to deal with boredom and restlessness by trying something.
I need to get on the air at WBAI.
You're on now, Alan.
Because, Alan, I think you're talking about where the medical profession, Dr. Robert Shaw, me being a firebrand psychiatrist who talks about opiate addiction and how it's doctors' fault, I will also say that lots of times middle-aged men and women come to our office and we'll give them Prozac. We'll give them medication. We're not doing the psychological, emotional, spiritual work.
No, what do you know about holding? I don't want to take drugs. I want to know what you know about
Alan. Listen,
about Melaleuca, vitamin C.
Alan. Listen, we're gonna leave you my number at the end of the show. Listen up for that, and if you want to talk to Kent,
do me a favor. Would you guys be nice? A doctor would be nice enough, since I'm blind and have diabetes, and would you come down to the nursing home and see me and sit down and talk to me? I really would like to talk to you.
I'm going to give you our number, and you call us, and we'll see what we can do about that. Thank you, Alan.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. Dealing with a lot of issues, 212-757-5555. I would have liked to have heard about his friend Dave, who passed away. I think you're right, Kent. I think, you know, instead of doing the emotional work and the spiritual work and the psychological work, people will take a medication to get on to the next phase of life, or to get through with the difficult phase of life.
Or to stay youthful. Again, Prozac, Viagra, you know, Rogaine, whatever. I don't want to become middle-aged. I want to be Peter Pan. I want to be, go to dermatologists and spend money. I don't want to grow older, because it's embarrassing, because younger is better. And I think we're saying that's certainly not true. And just taking medication to put a band-aid on what is really an emotional, spiritual crisis that you're going through, that you really want to come out of, not just to narcotize and medicate either with Prozac or addictions and behaviors. You want to work it through so you become at peace.
And it's certainly easier to take a pill that's going to boost our serotonin than to uncover the difficulties and the pain and the trauma that may be lying beneath. But that's the hard work that allows us to get to a place of lasting well-being.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
And that's the important part of that.
Yeah. And that's why this crisis is really a turning point. It can be a chance for real choice in life. You get to choose. If you take a pill, you stop choosing. You stop confronting the drama and the story. And only if you go through the drama and the story and the emotions that go with it do you get to re-envision a future for yourself, a way to get from here to the end.
Well, we talked about testosterone with men. We didn't talk about women and estrogen and how menopause is more finite with them. And that, again, with the decreased estrogen, a lot of women don't need to caretake their husbands and caretake their children, and even sometimes caretake their friends, right? Again, it's almost like estrogen on steroids. And so then once they're a little older, they're really in a place where they can be quote-unquote selfish, right? Because women are taught that if you're looking out for your own creative outlet or a career or your own goals, that's selfish. Your job is to nurture and take care of. Well, the empty nest or divorcing husband or something like that, and your own lowering estrogen can be very empowering for women, like Gail Sheehy talks about in Passages, of becoming their own person about what they want to do and where their power lies. And some women, again, my whole life, again, my power is taking care of others and nurturing, whether no one needs my nurturing anymore, or more importantly, there's not that estrogen push anymore. And so finally, I can go back to school and start my little shop or do volunteer work. Mm. Or
and embracing selfishness as a virtue at that point.
100%. Right. Quote unquote selfishness as opposed to healthy, putting your needs and wants first.
Right. Because for so many women, there's this pressure to be so perpetually selfless that, right, that this sort of biological shift that you're talking about can afford many women an opportunity to really focus on themselves, which is quite an opportunity.
Yeah. So if you're a mother of five kids, I mean, that's a huge career. Absolutely. You know, that's a lifelong, you know, some mothers can use that for the rest of their life, but the kids have left 30 years ago and they're still in the mother role.
Well, and I think it's win-win because the number of 20-year-olds that come into our office that say, Mom is still trying to take care of me and I don't want her to anymore. So it's win-win. The child is saying, I don't need your caretaking. And the mother is sort of saying, okay, now it's time to take care of myself for the first time.
So I think that, Kent, you opened a can of worms here today. It's a really great topic. That crises as a turning point in your life. I think people need to mourn, though. I think people need to mourn their past and process where they've been in order to get to where they want to get to. Kent, thanks for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
If you want to reach us here at the Center, Alan, you can reach us 212-757-4488. I'm Kev O'Donoghue.
Here with Ben Starr. And thank you, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
We're here every Tuesday and Wednesday at 1, and you can find us on iTunes. Just search for The Positive Mind. Get free downloads of every episode if you missed them live.
Just one last thing. Tomorrow we have, where we're returning to our topics of women's psychology. We'll have a guest, Elizabeth, who will be talking to us about all the nurturing things that women can do for themselves post-menopause, post this adjustment, Ken. Maybe you'll want to sit in on this.
It would be my pleasure.
You're invited. See you tomorrow, folks. Thank you.